WSLR-LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV-LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. You can find us on the web at WSLR.org. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. This is the Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barisonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them. George Sakroukledis spent 20 years working for multinational corporations, focusing on social research, data analytics, consumer marketing, and advertising. It gave him a deep understanding of the inner workings of the most exploitative entities on the planet. He came away from the experience with a mission to expose the fantasy of endless growth. In his latest book, Franken-Politics, he takes a deep dive into understanding how the drive for global profits have brought us to the brink of a civilization-ending climate crisis. George, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for connecting with me.
This whole system depends on our cooperation, and we're born into it and given a set of rules to follow. How does our education system and economic system force people into jobs and lifestyles that make them miserable?
Yeah, that's very on point. And I wish it was only our educational system that was the problem, but let's take that as one example. So our education system is just one of the casualties of capitalism, quote unquote. But it is a crucial one because it sets the stage for an individual's progression into society and the sort of expectations that people have of what they're going to do for the rest of their life. Well, as with every facet of human existence, education too has been monetized. This essentially means that it doesn't operate on the basis of providing a social service, but to generate profit for universities and their stakeholders. But this is all very cleverly concealed from us. Our educational system still serves us the myth that education is here to make society a better place and that it is here to make us personally more fulfilled. But it fails miserably on both because ultimately it is a preparation step for corporate life. The reality out there in the real world where you have to surrender your ethics and your values in order to do your job. And this goes for, sadly, for everybody, you know, even doctors and gardeners. You know, when you start dissecting their roles, you realize how much of their value system they're actually giving up. Doctors working with pharmaceutical companies, accepting bribes that are completely legal, using single-use products, plastic essentially, all through their day, because that is the capitalist conveyor belt that operates in the back of a hospital's finance department, and which is why our healthcare is so incredibly expensive, because nothing is ever recycled or reused.
And then what winds up happening is we all get co-opted, because then we're dependent on the system. And it makes it incredibly difficult to have any effective change because we've all been captured by it. So we wind up being complicit in the destruction.
Absolutely. And as you say in your question, it does make us miserable because essentially it kills our true self. I would say for me personally, it was mostly around my senior year in college. I was quite active in the government within the college. I was also heading up Amnesty International. I was doing all these ethical things, and it had to become a separate part of my life. It had to become a part of me that I had to hide from the rest of the world almost. We become these split personalities. One is our corporate personality that is completely ruthless and has no values and no ethics so that we can get that salary. And then that other part of us, which for some lucky people, it's still there in some form. And for others, it has completely died. And then people wonder why they are feeling miserable and why they're feeling unfulfilled. And they start taking yoga and they start taking all these ridiculous things when really the answer was just be yourself and fight for the things that you believe in. But like you say, the system does not allow us to do that. We are complicit and we are immobilized, really, because we are tied into this economic system.
And the economic system won't indict itself to make change happen. But it looks like the change is going to be forced on us as we're running up against the limits of a finite physical universe in a system that demands endless growth.
Absolutely.
There's a growing movement to recognize the legal rights for ecosystems and species. In your book, you talked about how in the fight for justice, the rest of the creatures on the planet weren't there. And it looks like this movement is a way of bringing them into the courtroom and saying, hey, you have legal rights too. Are you familiar with that movement? And how effective do you think that's going to be?
Yeah, I think recognizing the legal rights for ecosystems is the only way forward, really. Only if ecosystems become legally equal to us can we root out the human speciesism and supremacy, which is at the root of the ecological decline that has been ongoing for thousands of years. As long as we humans feel that we're entitled to this planet to destroy and that all other 10 million species are here for us, not for themselves and not for the whole of the earth, and that we can just use them as we like, as long as our economy operates on the principle of bypassing ethics in its quest for profit, then all of us are under threat, not just other species, not just the ecosystem. This is a major, I think, realization that hasn't happened, that because everything has become a business, ethics itself is disappearing because it's an obstacle to profit. And this is why we see more genocides, more autocracies, more ecological catastrophes. Putting nature on par with humans on a legal basis would be a revolution. What I always say, one of my favorite quotes of mine, is that at the center of our existential crisis has been our failure to understand the politics of the ecosystem. Earth only works as a federation of 10 million equal species, not a dictatorship of one. If we are instituting an autocracy on the ecosystem, what do you think we will have in our societies? It will all be autocratic. And arguably, it has always been, but that's another discussion.
And the problem is, we're having a hard time, especially here in the United States now, getting any sort of voice for all of the people. And it's going to be a really hard sell to have people look at non-humans and say, oh, they need rights too. Climate protest is very different from the past struggles around issues like racial equality, women's rights, and the labor movements. And you go into that a little bit in the book. How is climate protest different from those other struggles?
It's very different. Climate protest is the most difficult protest ever. You could say very confidently it is failing and it has failed, and it looks to me that it will continue to fail. Climate protest is not a protest about a very specific problem. It is, by definition, an anti-systemic struggle. It is about everything. It is about the entirety of our civilization and the foundational values of this economy, which is growth and human supremacy over other species. You know, I always, for me, these are the two big culprits of human civilization, is the obsession with growth in all forms, whether it is economic, population, industrial, technological growth, or human supremacy. So an anti-systemic struggle becomes entangled in a tug of war with the entire system, right? It's not against a specific group of people. So that's why you have everyone in the backlash against climate protests, not just the corporations. You have mainstream society as well that is against climate protests. Look at what happened to Extinction Rebellion in the UK. It was the general public that was really indignant about people stopping trains and doing all this disruption. They just thought, well, I just want to get to my job.
Because right now, the impacts are starting to be there, but our day-to-day lives haven't really been hit extremely hard.
Yeah, and this is the other difficult thing about climate protests, that it is about something that is going to happen, not about something that is happening right now. Even though we are currently entering an accelerated collapse, we see that in the prices of our food, which has little to do with tariffs and a lot to do with the situation in the bread baskets across the world that are being impacted by adverse climate. As long as this normalization window keeps shifting, people don't realize the impact of the climate crisis. And the other reason is that, again, it is a very big issue. It's not about a specific human right like women's vote or LGBTQ or other struggles where you can just satisfy a specific group of society and bring them in equal standing with others. This is about everyone. So again, it's a very, very big ask on society to solve the climate, because that would require solving the fundamental bedrock value system of our civilization.
And we don't really have a good grasp on how bad things are going to be unless we depend on the forecasts of the climate scientists. And you are by no means a climate denier, but you write that climate science is, quote, quickly becoming an art of unreliable speculation. What's going on there?
Well, I wrote that piece to be frank about the fact that our climate models are incapable of predicting and explaining and forecasting the weather, simply because these climate models were designed for a planet that doesn't exist anymore. Our weather systems are fundamentally shifting. And once we see, for example, the Atlantic meridional circulation, the AMOC reversed, then that's going to bring everything upside down.
But don't you think the models can be tweaked for that sort of thing?
Not if the planet is being constantly tweaked. Things are changing so fast that you can see that, because scientists are constantly being surprised. And the generic announcement now is that things are not what we expected by a long shot. We are completely shocked. We thought this was going to happen in 1,000 years, but it happened in 2 years. This is on the loop all the time. You hear this. I actually wrote that piece not as an attack to climate science. It was really to galvanize climate scientists to stop looking at the numbers and stop trying to create models. We know that things are bad, and we know that things are even worse than we could ever think. Become an activist. If you want to be a real climate scientist, go out there, make an emotional plea, because emotions are much louder than facts. Facts don't work in activism. I strongly believe that. We see that with everything that's happening, people are just trying to throw charts and facts and temperature curves at the problem. I did that in the beginning of my activism journey, and I stopped actually for many years now. I don't look at those things, I don't retweet them, I don't, because I know people just don't react to facts at all. It has to be an emotional plea, and it has to be a threat that they can perceive physically and emotionally in their body.
Like what you're hearing on WSLR? You can leave a tip for your favorite shows through our website, wslr.org. You'll find the Leave a Tip link in the On the Air box on our homepage. You're listening to the Progressive Page Turner. My guest is George Sakralides, and we're talking about his book, Frankenpolitics. Another part of the problem is we have this soothing narrative going on in the background saying, oh, but we'll just bring in some new technologies. And we've got all these green products and sustainable industries. And all we need to do is make sure we bring those online. How much of that is real?
None of it. Technology could have helped us if it was being used in the right way. Currently, all of these sustainable technologies are used unsustainably. From solar panels to carbon capture to electric vehicles, everything is done to make investors rich rather than to save the planet. The technologies have an immense carbon footprint for their manufacture and their continued use. Ultimately, if you think about it, the renewable industry is an oxymoron. It says that it aims for sustainability while preaching economic growth, jobs, and prosperity. Being sustainable means staying within your means. That's the definition of the word sustain, is to stay where you are and to keep, to maintain what you already have, to not want something more. So sustainability and growth are incompatible with each other. And this is why everyone is talking about degrowth. That's the only solution. But growth has become the paradigm of the green industry. So it's basically just capitalism all over again.
This is where the discussion about corporate culture comes in, too. In the book, you talk about how people are in positions where they're told to sell this stuff, even when they know that it's not real, it's not going to solve the problem. But there's so much pressure to check your values at the door.
Absolutely. What I always say to describe this situation is that we are part of a system that bribes us on a daily basis with salaries, with consumer products, with Netflix, you name it, with all sort of distractions, so that we check our values at the door and so that we turn a blind eye to all the crimes that are funding these bribes.
And then the bribes, of course, go into our political system, and then that creates another block to real change. There's a discussion in your book about how the politicians today are faced with the same dilemma as Agamemnon and Socrates. I really liked that analogy.
Yeah, I guess these are two brilliant examples, Socrates and Agamemnon, of people that were being thrown into an impossible dilemma of putting their country above themselves, or being asked, in the case of Socrates, to surrender their beliefs in order to save their life. This is what he was told in prison. Just apologize. Just say that everything that you said was BS, and we'll let you go free. And he said, no, I'd rather die. That's the last thing I want to do. And that kickstarted the renaissance in philosophy, which ended up being the biggest exports of Greek civilization. But I think that coming to today, and as we look at these examples, I think as with all Greek tragedies, they're quite extreme. I don't think it's that extreme today. I think it's actually possible to care both for your country and for yourself. If you realize that if you care for your country, ultimately you care about yourself because you're part of that country. Sadly, our politicians don't realize that. Our politicians have decided to be corrupt. This was never even a debate. And this is the perennial problem with all types of authority and government. Governments came into existence thousands of years ago, not to help societies, but to help themselves. This is the reality of what power is. As our societies grew into the thousands, and we needed these people that we never see and we never talk to be in charge. The more, let's say, corrupt individuals came forward and said, I'll do it. I'll be your leader. In school, we are taught that there's a reason to have governments and there's a reason to have power and to have authorities. But this is actually how power has always operated. It has always been corrupt. Whatever political system you have, whether it is a democracy or an autocracy, you always have a high level of corruption that is hidden from the public view because it's essentially legalized.
This is the anarchist argument against government. And the problem I always have with that is, don't you have to have some structure in place to protect the vulnerable?
I think there's different areas and different levels of anarchy. I don't know which one I am, but I do believe in structure quite a lot. I just think that structure cannot be defined on a countrywide basis. I think it has to be more local, where communities can take decisions and where the leaders live right next door to you, so they are accountable and they're responsible and they have a face and an address and they feel less, let's say, unbeatable.
Yeah, they do have an invulnerability when they're in the capital city, they're far away, and the only access you have to them is to petition them at a distance.
Imagine how different it would be if it was a village. If it was, let's say, a village at the Dunbar's number, which is supposed to be the ideal number of people in a human society, about 150 people, I think. And there's a reason for that number. It's because everyone knows each other and everyone gets to work closer and to be more accountable to each other. We have lost accountability, and we have lost accountability even within our own families. The more we are isolated from each other through technology, everyone's on their mobile phone, and we've become countries of one person within a planet of 8 billion people.
And the 8 billion number comes to another point. Overpopulation, it's a touchy subject because of eugenics, but 8 billion people is a lot, especially when there's people like me who live in a country where we consume far more than the rest of the world. But many countries in the world have birth rates that are far below replacement rates. And there's a little bit of a panic about how humans might be facing a population decline. Do you think this will have an impact on the ecological crisis?
You mean a positive impact on the ecological
crisis? A positive
crisis?
Impact, yeah, because you look at countries like South Korea and Japan, and they're really starting to panic because their populations are dropping. And it's true in countries like Italy, where they're asking people to come and live because the countryside especially is being hollowed out.
The only problem is that these countries are exceptions. If you look overall, the world population is still increasing. So to answer your question about the ecological impact, absolutely. I mean, you already see that in my country, Greece as well, where we have a huge problem similar to Italy. You see that forest cover is expanding in the country. And you probably see that also in Italy and Switzerland and many other European countries where a lot of the forests are beginning to recover because simply people don't live in the countryside anymore. They don't have their farms and they don't have their homesteads and that sort of thing. But again, these are exceptions. The population growth rate in the African subcontinent is actually exploding. And that's why the average is still going up. But I think aside from that, I think the point is really not whether the population of humans is increasing or decreasing, is what is the population of humans? And 8 billion is too much. Even if we took, let's say, 5 billion out and we were left with 2 or 3 billion, even that would be too much at the rate of our carbon emissions. And when you look at industries such as AI with these data centers that are overpowering the energy grids, the per capita use of carbon is dramatically increasing. Yeah, as of right now, I think that population is a huge problem and it has always been the biggest problem because it's what is behind growth. Growth is primarily driven by population growth. You tackle population growth and then you immediately tackle every type of growth that exists. It's like magic. No one, of course, wants to discuss that.
And I think the problem is going to be either we put limits on our own numbers or the planet's going to do it for us because it just can't continue. So what are your thoughts on how to escape catastrophe, or do you believe it's inevitable now?
Well, it is inevitable if something doesn't change, right? So as long as we continue to operate this civilization as a business, which is what my book is really about, is about the impact of capital on everything from education to our food system, to our politics, to our democracy, to absolutely everything. If we continue to operate as a business and to think of Earth as a supermarket, that is, we stock up the shelves with things that we steal from nature, eventually there will be nothing left to sell and the supermarket collapses. The only thing that could avert this is if we all have a big realization, which is to try to imagine ourselves outside of this system, try to detox ourselves from all the bribes that we were talking about that this system provides us. Because the biggest argument that I get from people when they read my work is, well, you must be joking. We can't defeat capitalism. I need all my gadgets and all my things. Well, do you really? It's kind of like, make an effort and try to imagine yourself or try to imagine how people lived quite happily without these things. A generation ago, I'm afraid that the only solution is a major awakening. An existential awakening on how we want to live, how we want to be, and what is it that makes us happy.
I think you're right. It has to be a change in the way we view ourselves and our place in the world. And unfortunately, that's not something that's being pushed on a daily basis, but the impetus to consume and keep consuming is there with the advertising industry pushing on us day in and day out.
It will happen for a lot of people, but it will happen as a result of a collapse. This is the toxicity of greed, that it doesn't allow us to appreciate what we have, what we always had on this planet, and to remember that we came to this planet already happy. This is the tragedy, that we are lost and confused and isolated and succumbing to mental illness. But actually, fundamentally, all 10 million species on Earth are happy.
You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest has been George Sakroklidis, and we've been talking about his book, Franken Politics. George, thanks so much for talking with me. It's been a great discussion.
It's been great here as well. Thanks very much for inviting me again.